From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Kim Brooks. We're talking about her new book, Small Animals. It's about the fallout from a single moment years ago when Kim left her 4-year-old son in the car while she ran into a store. The book is about how a growing culture of fear and anxiety and judgment has shaped modern American parenting and really changed the nature of childhood. We'll be right back.
The news cycle is moving incredibly fast these days. KUER brings you national and international coverage from NPR and the BBC. And the reporters in our own newsroom are following the Utah stories that affect your community. You can count on us for news and conversation that's calm, fair, and fact-based. Now we're counting on you to support that commitment during our fall fund drive. Make a one-time donation or become one of our 9,000 monthly sustainers. Go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The story at the heart of Kim Brooks' book, let's be honest, you might feel a little conflicted about. March of 2011, Kim stopped at a Target in Virginia where she'd been visiting her parents. She was pretty frazzled, feeling nervous about the flight back home, needed to get some headphones for her young son for the plane ride. So she pulls into the parking lot, goes to get her son out of his car seat, but he doesn't want to go inside. In the book, Kim writes that she looked at the clock, then back at her son, and she says for the next 4 or 5 seconds, she did what it sometimes seemed she'd been doing every minute of every day since having kids, that never-ending risk-benefit analysis. Now, remember, it was March, so it wasn't hot outside. She figured she could just lock the doors, crack the windows. It'd be fine. It's just a few minutes, so she leaves him in the car. And when she returns, he is fine. So she backs out. Story over. Well, not quite. Someone had filmed all of this there in that parking lot, a 4-year-old left in his car seat, and this person contacted the police. Now, we'll get to what happened after that in a moment, but Kim Brooks says that her ordeal with the authorities, it might just have ended there after all of that, with her feeling this profound sense of shame, but Kim didn't just leave it at that. She went and looked for other mothers who had been in the same kind of experience. And the book that she's written examines modern parenting and what it's like for children to be raised in this environment where they're constantly observed and their play is carefully controlled. This is also about the way parents assess risk and how moral judgment always seems to play a part. The book is called Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. Kim Brooks is joining us to talk about it. Kim's writing has appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, Salon.com. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR affiliate WBEZ in Chicago. And Kim Brooks, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to begin with the moment, obviously. We'll talk about what happened. I just sort of explained the basic story. But you write this in the book. You say beneath when you had arrived at the store and you're sort of making that assessment I mentioned, you write in the book that just beneath the reasons that you were going through was something else, something more serious, a small, quiet voice you describe that you had been hearing more and more lately. Could you explain what that was? What was that voice you say you were hearing?
Yeah, well, I think it was a voice of kind of analytical questioning, of reasoning, of sort of taking a step back and saying, you know, the things that we take for granted as parents that we're supposed to do, that everyone's doing, why do we do the things we do as parents? Why do we assess risk the way that we do?
Yeah.
And you know, do we have to sort of go along with the herd when it comes to all the choices we make as parents?
Yeah.
I think that that's sort of the voice that I'm talking about there.
Was part of this, was the voice also saying, this is dumb. He's going to be fine. When I was a kid, this would have been no big deal. I mean, were you thinking about that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. You know, I live in Chicago. I've raised my kids in Chicago. So in the city, this hadn't come up very much because I don't drive that much in the city. And, you know, we take public transportation. And when we do drive, I wouldn't have considered, you know, leaving them in the car while I run an errand because, you know, there are car thefts in the city and things like that. But when this took place, I was back in Virginia, which is where I grew up, a very rural suburban area. And, you know, in the back of my mind were all the times that I remembered as a child myself in the 80s, the early 80s, waiting in the car for a few minutes or longer while my parents ran in and did an errand and, you know, having the windows open, yeah, sitting back, reading a book, listening to the radio, things like that. And so, yeah, there was just this kind of questioning of, it doesn't seem like people do that anymore, that they run in for 2 minutes and let their kids wait in the car. But why? What has changed so dramatically in, you know, 30 years, in 20 years, mm-hmm, that something that used to be so commonplace is now not done, is now taboo? And you know, that was sort of that questioning voice that I was hearing.
I want to ask the obvious question, the one that you mentioned in the book that you always get from colleagues or family members or reporters or radio talk show hosts. When this happened, they said, how did you feel when you realized what was happening, that someone had recorded all of this, had contacted the police? Because you say in the book it took you a long time to be able to answer that question honestly to yourself. What do you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the dominant emotions were fear and shame or embarrassment. I don't know how many listeners have ever had someone call the police on them for something that they've done, but, you know, just in and of itself, it's a pretty upsetting experience. And, you know, having it happen with something, you know, not like... you know, running a red light or speeding ticket or something like that, but something that involved my parenting, which was obviously and it continues to be something that's very important to me and to my identity. And, you know, it was very upsetting and it was very, you know, my initial reaction was not a defensive one. It was not, you know, how dare this person call the police, or, you know, how could this be happening? It was more of just sort of bewilderment, yeah, that, you know, I couldn't understand, like, why this had happened, why someone would think what they had seen was dangerous enough to involve the police. And, you know, as a new mother, and I write a lot in the book about this feeling overall that I had as a new mother of sort of uncertainty and anxiety and being bombarded with so many decisions, the way I think many mothers are, you know, do you breastfeed or do you bottle feed? Yeah. Do you stay at home with your kids? Do you go back to work? What kind of childcare do you do? There's so many decisions to make and so many choices. And the problem is that when there's so many choices, the implication is that you can always choose wrong, yeah, or you can always choose better or choose worse. And so I very much, at the time this happened, you know, my son was 4.5, my daughter was 2, and I would not describe myself as a confident parent. You know, I had a lot of feelings of self-doubt, of insecurity, wanting to be a good mother, wanting to be the best mother that I could be, but not always knowing the best way to do that. And so to sort of be in that mindset and in that culture of kind of anxious parenting, mm-hmm, that I try to describe in the book, and then to be called out in this way and have the police called, was pretty upsetting. It, yeah, was pretty scary.
One of the things you mentioned at the time, you know, you were a wife, writer, mother of 2, and you say, you know, I feel like I knew my kids. I feel like I knew my parents, But you say you didn't know yourself, didn't know who you had been before the kids and how you had changed. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is an uncommon experience. You know, I had one sibling growing up, but I didn't grow up in a house with many children or with extended family. I knew I wanted to be a mother and to have children, but at the time that I had them, I had very limited experience caring for children. And so, you know, I think a lot of women have this happen where, you know, you go to college, you plan to have a career, you spend years sort of learning about your field, and then you have a child and you realize everything you've done in terms of your education and your training has not prepared you in any way for the actual work of parenting. There's a complete disconnect. And also, you know, there's just children in our society are often very segregated from adult life. Yeah. And so, yeah, there's just everything was sort of new to me in that way.
So when you talked to an attorney, he told you that that what you needed to explain, I want to quote you here, he said that what you needed to explain that is that you need to say to the authorities, this is him advising you, tell them that you are a responsible, regular, attentive, suburban mother who let her kid wait in the car while she went into a store to get one item, which you shouldn't have done, but you weren't thinking, you still did it, and the kid is fine. He said, you know, look, you have no history of abuse, you have no criminal record, no problem with drugs. He wanted you to say a momentary lapse in judgment. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot in there that we'll get to. But did you agree with that when he said this is what you need to convey to them? How did you react to that?
Well, yeah, at the time I did agree. And, you know, later when I began interviewing other women who'd had similar experiences, I found out that this is very common, that when this happens to mothers, they're often sort of intimidated in this way into just admitting, you know, oh, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, with the hopes that will make it sort of go away quickly. Because, you know, as I was explaining, it's a very upsetting experience. And, you know, there was a point later on in the book when I'm describing actually going into juvenile court or preparing for that, you know, as I'd started researching this issue and learning about it and really challenging and pushing back against the idea that I had done something that was risky, I said to my lawyer later on at one point, you know, I don't really think I did anything wrong. I don't think that I made an irrational or I don't think that I made a dangerous choice. Yeah. I think I made a rational decision and there's no law against doing this specifically. And he sort of said, yeah, well, this is going to be tried in juvenile court were you to go to trial. And juvenile courts are notorious on erring on the side of protecting the child, and you don't want to lose your kids over this. It's not worth it. And I think that this is very common, that a lot of parents in my situation are sort of scared or intimidated into waiving their rights, into, you know, saying, oh, I did something wrong, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, because you just want it to go away. And when it comes to, you know, your kids' well-being, you don't want to take any chances. Yeah. The problem, of course, is that if everyone is waiving their rights in this way, then we effectively have no rights as parents or as mothers.
So you decided to go to try to find women who had been through a similar experience. Ultimately, there are, I think, six women talked to you, and we'll get to some of the stories of some of these women here in a moment. But was that difficult to get them to talk to you? And did you find that you related in some way? Were they willing to go on record, I guess, as well?
Yeah, well, not only was it not difficult, but actually in many of the cases, the women sought me out. Yeah. you know, I originally wrote, I first wrote about my experience in an essay for Salon, I think it was 2014. And, you know, I had, at the time that I wrote the essay, I mean, I was a writer, I was a journalist. I wrote a lot of personal essays, many of them about parenthood. But I had no intention of writing a book on this subject. But what happened was I wrote this essay, and so many people started reaching out to me after that essay saying, you know, thank you for writing this. The same thing happened to me. Something similar happened to me. I thought I was alone. I was ashamed, you know, and now I have more understanding about this subject. So it was really that women started coming to me that I thought there's a story here. There's a cultural story that's bigger than just my experience being a fluke.
Yeah.
So some of the women I interviewed in the book reached out to me. Some of them I reached out to. But no, I mean, most of the ones I talked to were so eager to share their stories. And, you know, it's something that there's so much stigma surrounding, you know, these things that mothers are shamed for, that I think a lot of people find it very freeing when they have an opportunity to speak honestly about their experiences.
That's Kim Brooks. Her book is Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Kim Brooks, and we're talking about her new book, Small Animals. It's about the fallout from this single moment years ago when Kim left her 4-year-old son in the car while she ran into a store. The book is about how a growing culture of fear and anxiety and judgment has shaped modern American parenting and really changed the nature of childhood. One of the things you write about is the actual statistics that are there, the actual chances that someone would abduct your child, that a stranger would do that. And they're crazy, the statistics and the chances. But as you say in the book, we've abandoned reason. And one of the things you explore is why it is we've done that. And I wanted to ask you about the work of Barbara Czarnecka. Mm-hmm. She's a cognitive scientist at the University of California, Irvine. And you reached out to her because she explores how risk assessment and moral judgment are intertwined. Talk a little bit about what she's developed and these vignettes that she presents to subjects in these studies that she does.
Sure. So she created an experiment where subjects were presented with a scenario that a parent has left a child for a few minutes unsupervised in a car in a cool covered garage, public parking garage or something like that. And she varies the reasons that the parent has left the child. So in some cases, it would be something completely out of the parent's control, like they were returning a grocery cart and they were struck by another vehicle, unconscious. In other scenarios, it might be that the parent had to run into work to give their boss an assignment. In other scenarios, it might be the parent is going to meet a lover. And, you know, so she varies the reason. And so, of course, and then she asks the subjects, you know, how wrong is the thing the parent did?
Yeah.
So trying to get at sort of moral judgment. And then how risky, how much risk did the parent put the child in? So, of course, you know, you would expect that as the reason changes, the assessment of the wrongness, the moral judgment, that that would vary. And it did. But what was not expected and what was very, and what I think, groundbreaking is that she found that also their assessment of risk followed. So people actually think that, you know, the parent who leaves their child for 5 minutes for a reason that they view morally dubious, mm-hmm. they think the child is at a greater risk being unsupervised for those few minutes, which, of course, doesn't make any logical sense, right? That the child, whatever risk the child is experiencing, is constant, regardless of the parent's reason.
Yeah.
But, you know, so what she sort of is uncovering there is that often I think when people think that they're seeing something dangerous, that they're seeing a child doing something dangerous, what they're really doing is they're morally judging the parent's behavior,
yeah.
often the mother's behavior, and then sort of using risk as a rationalization
yeah.
for that judgment.
Here's what Dr. Czarnecki and her colleagues concluded. People don't think leaving children alone is dangerous and therefore immoral. They think it's immoral and therefore dangerous, which is really interesting. You mentioned in the book that this isn't about safety as much as it is enforcing this, what did you say, a social norm, I think.
Right. And then, you know, the question that begs, which is one I explore in the book and I'm continuing to explore, is why do we suddenly think it's immoral then
yeah.
for children to be left unsupervised? What has happened? And, you know, my personal opinion is that it has a lot to do with women reentering the workforce in the 70s and 80s mm-hmm. and sort of our nationally ambivalence about, you know, mothers working. But, you know, there's different theories. People can present different theories, but somehow this has sort of become something we believe with almost religious certitude, that leaving a child unsupervised is somehow morally wrong, mm-hmm. that you're doing something wrong when you do that.
The other thing that it reveals, it seems to me, and raises the question of just how we look at people from different social status or racial or even gender bias plays into all of this. Tell us a little bit about Deborah Harrell, because her story is, I think, instructive about who calls the police and why people call the police. This was interesting.
Deborah Harrell was a mother that I reached out to, and her story was in the news around the same time that I wrote the essay about my experience. So she was a single mom, African-American woman. Her daughter was, I think, 9 when this happened.
Yeah.
They were living in South Carolina, and she was a manager at McDonald's, and her daughter was out of school for summer vacation. And her daughter asked one day if, instead of staying at home, where I think the neighbor usually kept an eye on her, if she could go to the park. All of her friends from school went to a particular park that was not very far from the McDonald's where her mom worked. So Deborah said, you know, yeah, I think that's fine. You know, better for her to be at a park playing, having fun, getting fresh air, than sitting in an apartment all day watching TV. She let her daughter play in this park while she went to work. Her daughter had a cell phone, and she had a cell phone, so she could call her if there was any problem. But the problem that occurred was that after, I think, the second day that she did this, she received a call from the police. And apparently one of the parents in the park had seen Deborah's daughter playing by herself and had called the police and said that, you know, they were worried she had been abandoned because she wasn't being watched by a mother. I mean, despite the fact that there were many adults there watching their children. So what was so interesting to me, though, about Deborah's case is that it was similar to mine in terms of her her so-called crime, right? But it was very unsimilar in terms of what happened. So her daughter was taken into a group foster home for 14 days.
Yeah.
She wasn't allowed to call or talk to her mother, which was very traumatic because they had never spent a night apart. They were very close. Deborah was arrested. She was taken into a jail. She spent, I think, 3 days in a jail. She was interrogated by a police officer without a lawyer, basically called a bad mother. And then ultimately she lost her job. And then while she was fighting this case legally, which she was able to do because Lenore Scanese, who's the founder of the Free Range Kids Movement, was able to help her find legal counsel. You know, she had trouble at first getting a job. She couldn't leave the state with her daughter. So this had serious, serious repercussions for her life and for her ability to support herself and take care of her child. And what I realized in sort of talking to her and learning about that case is that whenever we criminalize something that many people are doing, like allowing their children some freedom or taking their eyes off their children, it will hurt people of color. It will hurt working mothers. It will hurt poor people disproportionately. And that's sort of what we see happening with a lot of these cases. The other thing that really I think is important about this case that I'm writing about is that she, when you think about her case, you think, well, what were really her options? I mean, the cost of daycare in this country rises every single year. On average, it now costs $17,000 a year to put an infant in daycare. When we say that to be a good parent means that either you watch your children every second of every day or you pay some other adult to watch them every second of every day, basically what we're saying is that poor people can't be good parents or even working class people cannot be good parents. We're saying that to be a good parent is to parent like an affluent white person at the beginning of the 21st century.
Mm. A good part of the book is also about what this is doing to the nature of childhood. You mentioned this conversation you had with a friend. You were talking about being parents, and he said that, it's really tough to be a parent, but it's also really, I think he put it this way, a horrible time to be a kid.
Mm-hmm.
He said something just feels wrong. Something feels different. What did he mean? Because I think this is another theme in the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's referring to, and he gives kind of a funny example that I go into where he says, you know, when he was growing up in the 70s, he says some of his happiest memories of childhood were that he would just go outside after school and there would be some friends in the neighborhood and they would play soccer or they would, like, go to the park and play baseball and they would be home by dinner. And he was like, you know, now it's like, before the kid even picks up the bat, they have to be signed up for a league and they have to be driven there and they have to have, you know, a special coach from the Dominican Republic coming in and giving them batting lessons. And so he's sort of joking, but, you know, I think it's a real point that our kids today are so structured, largely because of these new norms, you know, that tell us that they have to be supervised all the time. Well, so how do parents do that, right? Mm-hmm. How do you go about doing that? Well, one of the ways that we do that is that we structure them. We put them in activities. We have them go from school to practice to lessons. And they have very little freedom, very little independence, very little autonomy. And the problem is that it's very bad for kids.
Yeah.
It's bad for parents and it's bad for kids.
A friend of yours said that it wasn't really like that in Europe, or at least didn't seem to be, not where she lived anyway. She said Europeans tend to be more relaxed about parenting. And what's interesting about this story is what happened to your friend's son when they came back to live in the United States. He tell a little bit about this. He became really anxious and withdrawn and depressed. He develops this internet addiction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this was a story that I was reporting for New York Magazine. And the mom in this story, she had lived abroad with her children. The parents had lived abroad. And she'd come back to this suburb, this very affluent suburb of New York, kind of thinking it would be the way it was when she had grown up there, which was very idyllic and safe and kind of unstructured. But instead she found that, you know, the parents drive their children everywhere. The children don't do anything on their own. All their social lives and social engagements are completely scheduled by adults. And you know, one of her children, her son, became very depressed, became very lonely and bored and anxious, and sort of develops a screen addiction. Yeah. And you know, I think parents worry a lot these days about screen time. But to me, it's not surprising that kids become addicted to screens and that they want to be on screens and on the internet, because honestly, that's the only time we leave them alone. Yeah. That's the only, you know, that's how they can connect with friends without adults sort of looking over their shoulders and supervising it. And so I always say it's not enough to just limit screen time or to get them off of screens. We need to also get them back into the public spaces, into the real physical realm, and have places they can go and things they can do on their own.
Now, you mentioned you interviewed her son, Shep was his name. And it was interesting you say that talking to him, interviewing him, gave you this, it seemed like this kind of powerful reaction. You said you felt this terrible sadness, a sadness that kind of turned into this really deep compassion for kids.
Yeah, you know, and because people will ask me a lot, and since I've been doing interviews, people will say, like, well, what do you think the impact is on bubble wrapping children and not giving them any freedom and all these things we're doing? And the question always sort of mystifies me a little bit, because I always think, well, what would the impact be on you?
Yeah.
You know, what would the impact be on us as adults if suddenly you couldn't go anywhere without someone going with you? You had no time by yourself. You didn't get to decide what you did with any of your own time. You're in every second of the day, from the moment you woke up till the moment you went to bed, was structured. You know, you couldn't ever be outside or just do things outside on your own. And, you know, I'll say this and people will say, well, that would be terrible. I'd probably be really depressed and anxious and I don't know what would happen. And so I say, well, I think that's what's happening to children. You know, children are people. I think that I don't know why this strange thing has happened over the last several decades, that in the name of protecting children, we've stopped treating them like people.
Yeah.
With basic rights and, you know, and freedoms. And one thing that really disturbs me a lot about this is that, you know, all of the reasons that are given for taking these freedoms away from children, for not letting them do all these things, the reasons of, well, we need to protect them because they're fragile, because the world is dangerous, because they're too good and pure for the world, and all these are all the same things that have been said about women in the past.
Yeah.
And why women shouldn't have rights or shouldn't have freedom. And I, you know, I don't think that protecting women is a good reason for taking away their rights. And I don't know that protecting children is always a good reason.
We should mention Utah became the first state to protect so-called free-range parenting, which is interesting. Talk a little bit about how this works and whether or not you get a sense that this might be a movement that could be taking hold in other places as well.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it is. So from what I understand, Utah passed a law saying that parents cannot be charged or arrested for making reasonable parenting decisions, even if those decisions, you know, involve giving their kids freedom or independence. And I think it's an important first step, you know, because what I learned in my research is that it's not that, you know, people will often say, well, oh, I didn't know there was a law against letting your kid wait in the car for 5 minutes. And I always say, well, there isn't. Yeah. There's no law against that. There's no law, I don't think, in any state saying you can't let your kid walk to the park. What happens is that because norms have changed so quickly and so radically, there aren't really laws regulating any of this. So what happens is when a bystander or a police officer sees something that they don't like or that they view as not a good parenting choice, they sort of try to find a legal justification for punishment. You know, so they call it, like in my case, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, or they call it child endangerment, or they call it child neglect. So Utah was the first state to say, no, you know, you can't do that. You can't. It's not a crime to let your kid wait for 5 minutes without your supervision, to let your kid walk to school, to let your kid go to the park on his own. I think, though, that, and I like to stress that, I mean, I think it's an important first step, but I think that's only the first step, like saying we need to stop arresting parents and mothers for doing these things. I think, you know, there's so much more to do after we do that in terms of like renormalizing these things that were normal until 30 years ago, so that, you know, so that a parent who wants to let their kid play on the sidewalk isn't doing it on their own. And then also, you know, creating structures and policies that instead of criminalizing parents who are doing, in most cases, the best they can, are supportive of parents and families. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something the philosopher Hannah Arendt has talked about, this process called natality.
Mm-hmm.
And that she says this is a very crucial process. In fact, she said natality is, this is how she puts it, the miracle that saves the world from ruin. Say something about that.
Yeah, I think it's a really beautiful concept. I think that we as adults, it becomes very hard for us to see ourselves. And because we don't see ourselves, we don't see the world clearly. And so often we become trapped by our ideas, by our assumptions, by our culture. We become sort of trapped by it. And what she said, the amazing thing about children is that they're able to see things freshly, to see the world anew. And because they're able to do that, they're able to change the world. They're able to create change. You know, the thing that I find scary and upsetting is that when we don't ever let our children separate from us or differentiate themselves or sort of strike out on their own, I don't know that still happens, that kind of moral regeneration, because in order to see things new, you have to become your own person. You have to, you know, see that you're not just an extension of your parents.
Yeah.
You're not just something that they protect, that you are your own person with your own rights and your own boundaries.
I want to come back to Lenore Scanese. You mentioned her earlier in the program. Some may recognize that name. She became notorious years ago. She let her 9-year-old ride alone on the subway, and you know she's really pushed back. And as you say, she's been one of those sort of the pioneers in this free range parenting movement. And you had this conversation with her that you write about. And you talked about how you were feeling really discouraged about the state of parenthood in the country. And Lenore gave you this strategy I wanted to ask about. She calls it yuppie jujitsu. What did she mean? Explain the strategy. I thought this was great.
Right. So I had come to her and I asked her, you know, what we can really do, because I was feeling sort of discouraged and like it's so hard to change people's ideas on this subject. And her idea was that what we have to do is that you can't make people stop being afraid or irrationally afraid. All you can do is make them afraid of something else. So she says, you know, the thing to do is to not just is to say, if you don't give your children more freedom, if we don't give them independence, and let them sort of develop resiliency, then, you know, they're not going to get into an Ivy League school, and they're not going to start a Fortune 500 business, and so on and so on. So you sort of like her idea is you sort of have to beat them at their own game, and that's sort of the only hope, which I found funny, but also a little bit depressing.
Yeah. You write about the constant judgment that's out there right now, and I'm wondering what did you learn about this moral judgment that we seem to be applying? Is there anything new about that, or have we always been really judgmental? When, where does this come from? Is it exacerbated by, you know, social media or some kind of modern dynamic? I mean, where does the judgment come from, or are we just naturally judgmental as human beings?
Well, I think we're naturally judgmental, and I think people have always been judgmental. I don't think that our basic psychology has changed. I think people often use judgment, as a reinforcement to tribalism, right? Mm-hmm. To sort of figure out who's one of us and who's not one of us, and then also to, you know, manipulate their place on the social hierarchy. But I do think that what has changed is how easy it now is. It's so easy now to post an image or a video or a snarky comment on social media to put someone down and then get all this positive reinforcement. You know, you get 100 people like that you did that. And so it becomes very easy, and it becomes sort of addictive and irresistible, I think, to do that.
You tell the story near the end of the book that I would say just seems kind of astonishing given what you had gone through. You were in this fancy hotel pool, and your kids were there enjoying themselves, and you saw this French couple who had their baby with them, and they put this baby in a pair of floaties into the pool and kind of got walked away. And you were kind of shocked by that. In fact, and this is the amazing part, you grabbed your cell phone and started recording this kid being left alone in the water. Talk a little bit about that. I thought that was a really honest and interesting moment.
Well, I should say I didn't actually do that.
Oh, you did? You wanted to.
I wrote that I did it, and then I wrote just kidding.
Okay, I got it. Okay, I didn't get the just kidding part. Okay. Yeah, that would have been astonishing.
Yeah, that would have been astonishing if I did that at the end of all my misadventures. No, what I did was because I was actually nervous for this baby.
Yeah.
And what I did was, because I was in the pool, is I kept an eye out on the baby.
Yeah.
You know, and because it just seemed like the obvious thing. It wasn't my baby,
no.
But it was a baby, and yeah. I was nervous, and I was in the pool. So I just, you know, made sure the baby wasn't going to drown. And, you know, I think that that's significant, though, because in many ways I think that that's the answer to all of this,
yeah.
Is that we have to sort of have a more communal sense of responsibility for each other's children. And I think we've gotten into this moment of hyper-competitive parenting where it's every mom for herself. You know, it's everything is about making sure your kids are okay, that your kids excel and succeed. And the problem is that it's impossible.
Yeah.
Like I really, and maybe this is the thing that I learned most from writing Small Animals, is that I really do not think it's possible for one or two people to give a child everything that child needs to grow and thrive and be successful. I don't think it's possible. And when we make that the expectation that no one can help us, that we're not helping anyone else with their children, no, we're not looking out for each other, that the best way to help, the only way we know how to help is to call the police on each other, then it's like we're doomed. I mean, and I think our kids are doomed. I don't think it's possible. I think that we need to broaden our notions of what it means to be a parent and a member of a community that includes children.
That's the writer Kim Brooks. Her book is Small Animals: Parenthood in the Age of Fear. She joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Kim Brooks, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directs the show, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Dan Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.